Father, I thank you for the opportunity of being together again as a class today, and I pray that you'll open our minds, send your spirit to guide us and instruct us. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, we're going to have some fun right now. Are you guys ready for some fun? Well, this one's pretty interesting to me because about three different people came up to me after the session this morning, and they said, "You didn't tell us about what you did with your garage sale money yet." So I'm fixing to tell you that right now. Here it is. We've already been through this amortization schedule business. Let me just tell you that any time you make a regular payment and one is due every month, no matter what else you do, you make one regular payment. Does everybody understand that? Okay. But any time you make a regular payment, you can add any amount of additional principal payments to your house payment and save the corresponding interest. For example, as I told you, when you make payment number one, and by the way, this column right here and that column there, when you add them up, write it line across, line across, line across, whenever you add those two up, the total is always $617. Do you see what I'm saying? As you pay, the one side changes a little bit and the other side changes a little bit. Like this is a little bit more goes to the principal, like a few cents each month, and a few less cents are charged for interest. Now remember that story that I told you, that I told this young couple, if you guys would double up your house payments, oh, we could never do that. But just if you add the principal of next month's payment, and I told you that the next month's payment was $17.34, about taking your family out to Taco Bell or, you know, Pizza Hut or whatever. And the thing is that you save $599. Well, now here's the, you know, that's pretty expensive pizza, isn't it? If you eat the pizza instead of put it on your house. But at any rate, after making a whole year's worth of payments of $617 12 times, you've given the bank $7,188 and you've only reduced your loan by $217. Now, sometimes because the payments are so high, young couples particularly think, well, we've been paying on our house now for 3 years. We've probably got this big equity in it. But unless there's inflation, you can add them up yourself. And there's, you know, right here, maybe $700 worth of equity. And that would hardly even pay the realtor's fee to sell it. Do you see what I'm saying? Now, here's something amazing. How much money did I make in my yard sale? After the vegetarian burrito supper and drinks at Taco Bell, we netted out $245, right? Well, we actually did that. It's just a coincidence that this amortization schedule, if I made all of next year's payments in a timely manner, how much would I pay on my principal? $245. So if in December, when I make my regular payment, I just add $245 to that payment, what did I just accomplish? I paid a whole year's worth of house payments in one fell swoop, and I saved myself $7,160 that I never have to pay. So if you divide, you know, $245 into $7,160, I will tell you it goes 27 times. So that is 2,700% return on the investment. Now I'm going to ask you a question. I just showed you how to make 2 years worth of house payments at one time, right? Make the regular monthly payments and then have a yard sale, right? You can put that money on your house payment. Now I told you that I was going to tell you about 8 years worth, right? This is going to make some of you very upset what I tell you next. Have you ever heard of an IRA, individual retirement account, that you can put like $2,000 away tax-free? My suggestion is pay the taxes on it and then put the $2,000 on your home mortgage. Now listen carefully. Instead of putting it in an IRA where you can't touch it without penalty of both principal and interest until you're age 59 and a half, why not just pay the taxes on the $2,000 and put it on your home mortgage? Now here comes the fun part. By the way, if you have an IRA, what would your current interest be, the interest rate that you would be getting on a good IRA right now? 3, 4, 5%? well, let me give you 10%, and that would be a double what you'd normally get. All right, you got an IRA that you can't touch without a penalty of principal and interest till you're age 59 and a half. Why not just pay the taxes and put the $2,000 on your home mortgage? Now, here comes the fun part. You have paid 1 year's payments, and you've had your yard sale. Now you get out an adding machine with a tape on it. You know what I'm talking about, the paper tape that comes out? And you start adding principal payments here until the total adds up to $2,000. Do you know what it would do? It would pay 6 years' worth of house payments and save you $42,000 worth of interest that you never have to pay. Now, why would anybody ever put money in an IRA if they owe money on their house? I can't figure it out, unless you just want to help the government or something. Do you understand? This is pretty serious stuff. Now, the whole point of it all is, but some guy comes up to me and says, but I was planning to get $600 a month from my IRA after I retire. And I said to him, well, what's your house payment? About $600 a month. Why not pay off your house and live that much cheaper in retirement? Makes sense to me. Let me tell you one other thing. All paper investments are subject to 100% loss in a failed economy. Did you hear what I said? Your IRA could disappear, period. You could lose it. But if you've paid off your house, you at least have a place to live. Does that make sense to anybody? It makes sense to me. Let me tell you another thing about that. You say, but you know, I can borrow against my IRA, or I can do this, that, or the other. The point is, when you invest in your home, you're investing in your own net worth, and should you ever need any money, what better thing for security than your home, which the interest would be tax deductible if you got a loan? Does that make sense? Okay. Now let me just tell you something, and this is really, really sad. Some banks are unscrupulous. Did you hear what I said? Some banks are unscrupulous. So I'm going to tell you what I mean by that. Let's presume that a local branch bank has 12 employees, and the branch manager lines them all up across the front of the bank windows there and says, this guy has sent in some extra money beyond his principal payment. What do you think he wants to do with this money? So he says, number one, what do you think? Well, I think he probably wants to pay some extra on his principal. Do you know that everybody in the bank would say the same thing? But unless you told the bank in writing that you wanted that to go to your principal, even though everybody that works there knows it, they'll put it in your taxes and escrow account even though you don't need any money there. Did you hear what I said? Some banks are unscrupulous. So the banks require that you notify them in writing if you're going to make a prepayment on your loan. And some people say, listen, I don't have to write letters. I don't know. In fact, they sold my loan. I got it here in Michigan, and someplace in San Antonio, Texas, or Cincinnati has my loan. And I don't know whether it's a man or a lady, and I don't know whether to say dear ma'am or dear sir, and you know, all that stuff. Listen carefully. A letter is not required. You know, any check you write, down in the lower left corner, there's a memo line. Just by writing something on that memo line, extra principal for loan number so-and-so, is all the writing that's required. Or if you have a coupon book, there will be a line that says extra principal. By writing any number on there, that designates the proper requirement of writing and notifying them in writing. Now, the reason that you have an amortization schedule is because you need to keep the bank honest. And if you have a mortgage, every once in a while, maybe every other year or every year, you get a loan, a letter from an auditing firm. I was going to make a wisecrack about Arthur Anderson, but I think I won't do that. They had the unique distinction of presiding over the largest corporate bankruptcy in world history with Enron, and the largest nonprofit corporate bankruptcy with the Arizona Baptist Association. In 1 year. Incredible. But let's just say that you get your letter from the auditing firm. It says, we're auditing the bank's records, and according to their records, on a certain date, you owe them so much money on your loan. What do you think the average family does with that letter? Just pitch it in the trash. Because they say the bank hardly ever makes a mistake, and this auditing firm, I mean, these guys are CPAs, they never make mistakes. But that is your opportunity to make sure that the bank is giving you proper credit for your extra payments. So here's what you do. And I'll give you another illustration that's kind of fun to think about. Assume for a moment that you, as a grown person, when it's Christmas time, you don't get socks and underwear anymore. They just give you a check. Because, you know, who knows what color you are, what size you are now, that kind of thing. Someone just sends you a check for Christmas for $100. What would you do with it? Well, in the past, I would tell my mother-in-law, I bought 2 new white shirts and 3 ties or something, you know, with the money you got me. And acknowledge it and thank her. Here's what I should have done. If you get, by the way, some people tell me, well, I just pay $50 a month or $80 a month, or I give them a $500 every once in a while, and I put that on there. I would suggest that you not do that. Get an amortization schedule. That's what one of these is right here, from your lending institution. Now, you can develop one on the internet, but that's only for your benefit, to kind of get an idea. If you want one that the bank goes by, have them provide it for you. I want an amortization schedule for my loan. And this is really, really interesting, because you don't want to just send them $200, because this is going to somewhere be part of a payment. You want it in increments of full payments. So, should you get $100 for Christmas and you have this loan, notice what you could do. When you make your December payment up here, you can add 19 and 19 and 19 and 19 and 20. And let's forget the cents right here for a second. So that's $96, right? Is that right? Okay. I would then write a check for extra principal for $96. I wouldn't just send him $100. So you can take then a magic marker with like yellow highlighter and go right across there and right across there and right across there till you get 5 of those. But for $96, you can draw a line right there and add up those 5 points of principal. And you can see easily that they're almost $600. I mean, you know, $2 and change, right? So let's just say 5 times 6. For $96, you can save $3,000 of interest and pay 5 payments on your house. Now, remember that you can't just sit around for 5 payments and rock in the hammock and not make another payment, right? Because you've got interest due every month. So every month you have to make at least 1 regular payment. But you can make as many extra principal payments as you can anytime, if there's no prepayment penalty. But you still have to make another payment. So the interest you save is the current interest right there. But the payment you save is at the end of your loan. And it keeps creeping closer and closer to you. Think of your loan as a rattlesnake. And you're not an ecologist. You've come across this thing that could bite you really bad and you want to kill it. But you have to start chopping with his rattles and keep chopping until you finally get him right behind the head and whack it off. That's paying your loan off. Do you understand? That's how it works. Now, the real interesting thing about this, some banks are unscrupulous. You're going to go home from camp meeting and go to your bank and say, this guy came to camp meeting and he had this real amazing thing about saving all this interest and paying your house off early. And some banker will tell you, I'll bet you he showed you the first 3 years, didn't he? That's when it's so dramatic, just a little bit of principal and a lot of interest that you pay. But you guys have been paying on your house for 5 or 6 years now. It's no big deal. Just keep making your regular payments. I've had many people call me and tell me that the bank tried to talk them out of prepayment. But listen carefully. In this loan right here, this is a 30-year amortization. It is not until 24 and a half years into the mortgage. You understand only 5 and a half years would be left, that you have half of a payment is principal and half of a payment is interest. So even 24 and a half years into the mortgage, you could make 2 payments by making a regular payment and half of another one. Isn't that incredible? Your goal is to be debt-free, including your home mortgage. And most people have no clue they can do anything but faithfully pay all 360 payments for 30 years. You want to pay it off. Isn't that true? It's important. Okay. Now, I could tell you some more stuff about this. I've had some real funny things happen about it, but it works. Lots of people have done it, including yours truly, and I can encourage you to do that. Okay? Now, does anybody have a question or comment about this? I know it's a big... Yes, please. Okay. Yeah, the question is, would you prefer this method to the biweekly payment thing? The biweekly payment would automatically cut about a third of the life of the loan off if you did that from the beginning of your loan. But what that does is it puts you into a situation where you have to make exactly a certain amount every 2 weeks. If you get paid every 2 weeks, that's no big deal. It cuts it down because you understand how biweekly works. I'll tell you how biweekly works. You make half a payment every 2 weeks, right? So how many full payments would that be? Okay, let me say it another way. How many if you pay every 2 weeks, how many weeks are there in a year? 52. So you'd make 26 half payments. That's how many you'd make. Every 2 weeks you'd make one, 26. Well, how many full payments would that be then? Just divide by 2 again, and you get 13. Do you see? So you'd make an extra full payment that would go 100% on the principal by making a biweekly payment. Each year, you make another full payment on the principal. And you could do that just now by making a 12th of a payment extra each month. Same result. But my suggestion is to use this one because you can make it variable anytime you want to. For example, if you wanted to have a pizza this month and it cost you $600, go ahead and have the pizza and then next month make an extra payment. Get the idea? Okay. That's the point. But biweekly is good. In fact, most Canadians are on biweekly payments in Canada. They use that a lot. But you don't even need to change your current mortgage to do this. You see what I'm saying? There are people that will call you up with these computer home programs, and they'll tell you, we'll put you on biweekly, and it'll save you so much money. But they want to charge you $300 to do it. Why not yourself pay the $300 and put it on your mortgage? It's a lot better. Okay? Anyone else? By the way, the book in Chapter 8 in the book goes through this whole thing, too. Yes, please. Yeah. It's $162,000. Yeah, the interest alone is $162,000. And by the way, if you're prepaying, if in some month you don't want to, you don't have to, but you can make lots of payments any month you want to. For example, if you sold a piece of property or something, or you got an inheritance, just put the money on your mortgage. But I would add it up with a tape to make sure you hadn't missed anything and make an exact amount of principal payment. Yes, please. Good question. The question is, if you already have a loan and you don't have an amortization schedule, can they charge you to get one? If you request it when you're going through the loan process, they usually provide it at the closing, complimentary. But if you don't have one, they can charge you up to $10 for one. Believe me, it's worth the money. You can see that. Okay. Yes, please. Yeah. Well, sure. The question is, if you're locked into a mortgage where you can't prepay, most of the prepay mortgages, where they're penalty, are just for the first 2 or 3 years. So if you're into it that long, it's probably lapsed already. But otherwise, the way you could do it is to get a total refinance, but they don't want you to refinance. They want you to pay them all the interest. So make sure that you don't have a prepayment penalty first. And by the way, this is another real interesting thing. If you buy a house and you go to the real estate closing, we call it, and there's like 15 documents that you as the owner and the guy who's getting the loan signs, it's really interesting that one of the charges is attorney's fees. And just to pull a number out of the air, it's typically about $300. Who is the attorney representing? The bank or the seller, but not you. Even though they charge you for the attorney's fees. The only time an attorney is representing you if you have personally engaged their services. Do you understand? So people have asked me to go with them to closings before, and I think I've earned my money a couple of times by just asking two questions. One of them is there a prepayment penalty on this loan? And the closing agent, typically a very smart young woman, will say, oh no, what's my second question? Where does it say that in the document? Because one of the things you sign last is, and it has bold print, no oral or verbal representation by either party is binding unless it is part of the written contract. So you make sure it's in there. There's no prepayment penalty. So you can make extra principal payments whenever you want to. We're going to go on to a couple of other real interesting things here. And if you have questions, I'll talk with you afterward. Larry Burkett, who many of you have heard on the radio and has written lots of books on money management, a Christian money management counselor, in his book, Investing for the Future, stated this: it is my strong conviction that becoming debt-free, including the home mortgage, should be the first investment goal for any young couple or person. Once you have achieved that goal, then and only then should you invest in other areas. This is from a Christian perspective, of course. Ellen White made an interesting statement. Had brother and sister B been economical managers denying themselves? Now, I've been kidding you guys about the pizza thing, but, you know, a lot of people eat out a lot. If you were willing just once a month to forego that and put the money on your principal, I mean, it's incredible what could happen. But if they could have denied themselves, they could have, ere this, have had a home of their own, and besides this, have had means to draw upon in case of adversity. You see the order? Pay the house off, then save up other stuff. Pretty interesting. And then this one is really neat. She says, Adventist Home 384, we are not to feel disturbed if our neighbors build and furnish their houses in a manner that we are not authorized to follow. Now, everybody actually thinks that this is like keeping up with the Joneses. You know, we all know that expression. But, listen, I know this may be a shock to some of you, but some people are not planning to go to heaven. Let me give you an illustration. You watch broadcast television. I'm talking ABC, CBS, NBC News, the NBC stations. Most of the people that you see on TV are not planning to go to heaven. I'm not judging the people. I'm not saying they're not going. I'm saying they're not even planning to go. And they make fun of those who are. Am I telling you the truth? That's one of the reasons not to watch TV. Because if we live and act like those people, we're probably going to end up where they're going to end up. The whole point is, we don't need to build our mansion down here, because if we understand the Bible correctly, God's building our mansion in heaven. Isn't that true? So I feel a little story coming on. And this is an interesting one. One night, I want to tell you about my house. One night, Kathy and I were sleeping upstairs in our master bedroom, and we both heard it. It woke us up. There was a loud crash. And Kathy said, Ed, did you hear that? And I said, yes. She said, what do you think it was? And I said, I don't know. She says, well, why don't you get up and investigate? So she's snuggling under the covers, and I'm getting up and investigating. I'm walking around the house with a flashlight because, you know, I don't want to just turn lights on. And anyway, I didn't think anybody could break in the upstairs where we were. So I went downstairs, and I checked all the doors and all the windows, and nothing was open, no sounds of anything that I could think about. So I went back upstairs, and I said, oh, it was nothing. She says, well, you heard it, didn't you? I said, yeah. I said, well, I did too. So I decided to look around the upstairs. And I went into the master closet where Kathy keeps her clothes. And what the noise had been was that Kathy's closet shelf and dress bar had fallen off the wall. And what we heard was, you know, shoe boxes and sweater boxes and stuff falling all over the place. That's what we had heard. We didn't know what it was. So I, fortunately for me, one of my college jobs when I was in college is I worked for a cabinet maker, and I knew how to put kitchen cabinets on walls. And so I said to Kathy, tomorrow I'm going to fix this. You'll be able to do chin-ups on your bar. You can do sit up there if you want to. It's not nothing you put on there would ever bring it down again. So what I was going to do was get a 1x6 fir board, finished board, and put it on the wall through the sheetrock into the studs with big 3-inch wood screws, and, you know, mount it on that so it's really strong. So I found the corner, and I took my carpenter's rule and measured over 16 inches, and I drew, had drawn a line there, and I tapped like a 12-penny finish nail through the sheetrock, just to make sure the stud was there. And the nail went clear in, didn't hit a thing. So I said, something's wrong. So I said, well, maybe they're coming on the studs from the other side. And so I went over that way and measured over 16 inches and put a nail through, and it shot clear in. What the bottom line is, they built this house on 24-inch centers instead of 16-inch centers in the framing. It's still just 2x4s. It's not 2x6s. And I told Kathy, I'd like to meet the guy that built this house someday. I'm sure he's not proud of it. My house, by the way, is covered with blue vinyl siding on the outside. This is not one of the options for our mansion. I can tell you that. If you want vinyl siding on your house when you get to heaven, you need to be telling God about it right now, because he's not going to normally use that stuff. Well, the reason I'm telling you all this stuff is the reason we bought that house is it was what we could afford without a big, long years and years of mortgage. But the neat thing about it, when it comes time to leave that place, to which we have no emotional attachment, we can walk out the front door and never look back. You remember Lot's wife, don't you? Nothing back there. That's important stuff. Okay. Because God's building our mansion in heaven. Didn't we get that part? Okay. Let's go on then. What we're going to look at now is the next one, and this is retirement. Do you know what the Bible says about retirement? I really love this question because it is the only question I ask that everybody in the audience always gets it right. Because most people don't know and they don't say anything, and you're right because it says nothing. Isn't that amazing? Now, there are only two verses in the Bible that talk about what you would construe as retirement. And the first one is Numbers 8:25, where it says that the high priest could no longer serve on the Day of Atonement in the most holy place after age 50. Now, you understand the significance of the most holy place, don't you, on the Day of Atonement? Do you know why the priest, when he went in, had a special robe? What was special about it? It's pure white linen, but there was something unusual about it. The bells. The bells. Around the hem of the garment was spaced every other one a little pomegranate with seeds in it and a little steel bell. So when he walked, it was just like jingling music. Isn't that interesting? But you know why it was there, don't you? Because he could go in the most holy place, and if there was sin in his life, if he was a pedophile, he would drop dead. Or if there was sin in the camp of Israel that was known sin that hadn't been dealt with, he could be just zapped and dropped dead by the Shekinah glory. There was one other alternative, and that is if he hadn't been following good health principles, he could have a heart attack and just die. And they just wanted to rule that out. So they said, you know, if you're age 50, you can still be a priest and do other priestly duties, but you can't go in the most holy place on the Day of Atonement. That's interesting, but it's not retirement. Now, let's go to the New Testament, and this is Luke, the 12th chapter. And we need to look at this because I will tell you, I've really appreciated the young people who have helped in the meetings at night to have the scriptures and so on. And one of the young men who was early in the week having the scripture, he said to me afterward, boy, I was really nervous. I said, join the group. I'm nervous every time I get up front too. And, you know, it's quite imposing to be up on the platform and look out and see 2,000 people out here that are always waiting for you to make a mistake. Well, I'm just kidding. But anyway, one of the most unnerving thing to a speaker is for somebody to stand up and start arguing with him during the sermon. In one of my first church districts, something unusual happened. There was a man in my congregation who had been in World War II, and he was adversely affected psychologically. You know, you've heard of shell shock or something like that. But what it was is that he thought everything had to be done exactly on time. The worst part about it was he sat on the front row. It wasn't actually the front row. It was the second row behind the first pew. But every Sabbath that man was at church, and that was almost every Sabbath, at 12 o'clock, he would stand to his feet on the front or second row, would not say a word, but he would remain standing until the service was over. Essentially, it was over when he stood, you understand, because everybody lost interest in what was going on. So whoever spoke there had to be done by 12 o'clock. So The reason I'm telling you that story is because we're going to see something similar in Luke, the 12th chapter. So let's turn over there. You'll see this in your Bible because it's pretty interesting to see. Luke chapter 12. Jesus is preaching, and if you have a red letter edition of the Bible, you know that the preaching started in verse 1, and he's speaking here about various things. And then he says, all of a sudden, while he was speaking, this guy stands up in the crowd and says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbiter over you?" Now, why do you think this guy stood up and asked Jesus to help him arbitrate the settlement of the family estate? Why would they ask Jesus that? Well, the Bible says he spoke as one who had authority. I asked my wife last night when I talked to her on the phone, "Any special news of the day?" She says, "Well, Ann Landers died." I was something like 85 years old or something. Well, I remember years ago reading in Ann Landers that somebody would write in, "My husband and I are having this argument about so-and-so, and we believe you know what this truth is or what the real score is, so whatever you say, that's what we're going to do." She was like an authority. You understand? Well, that's why this guy asked Jesus, "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." So what did Jesus say? He says in verse 15, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses." Now, here's what I'm going to tell you I think that means. If somebody mistreats you with an inheritance thing, don't lose your Christian experience over it. It's not worth it. God will take care of that in the judgment. You understand? Then he changed his sermon and he said this story. "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do since I have no room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I'll do this. I'll pull down my barns and build greater, and there I'll store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" Now, how would we say that in 2002? "I've got plenty of money. I think I'll take early retirement. I might even buy myself a motorhome and tour the country." That's what we'd say today. Now, there's nothing wrong with this, you understand. This is only an illustration. But I will tell you before I go further, there's a book you can buy in the Adventist Book Center, a compilation of the writings of Ellen White called The Retirement Years. Have you ever seen that book? It came out in 1990, General Conference, Indianapolis. The Retirement Years. Would you like to know how often the word retirement occurs in the 3-volume comprehensive index to the writings of Ellen G. White? It does not occur even once. And it only occurs in that book, in the title. Isn't that interesting? Obviously, there comes a time when age comes upon us, and because of advancing years, we don't have the mental sharpness or the physical abilities to continue to work, and we need to plan ahead for that. But it does not need to be the constant focus of our life from the day we start working till the end of time. It's a fact. And yet, most people, when they're working on the weekday, through the work week, they're thinking about two things all day long. Payday, and when I can quit this awful job. That's a lot of people are thinking that kind of stuff. So, you know, they're thinking about retirement. But anyway, Jesus said something after that. He said, this is verse 20, "But God said to him, 'You fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" This is amazing. You know, you got some stuff saved up, but how much do you have stored up in heaven? How much have he helped others? How much have he helped advance the cause of God? That's what it's saying here. So this is, again, by the way, this is the only time in the New Testament that retirement is discussed. And what is the name of the parable? The parable of the rich fool. Real interesting. Think about it and think about our focus and fixation on that also. We'll go on a little bit here. I mentioned to you about Ellen White and retirement. Here's something interesting. I attended a trust services seminar in Memphis, Tennessee some time ago with the Robert Sharp organization, which is a big-time counselor to trust organizations. And they said that there are common fears of older people. And I'm going to show you what they are. And I'm going to put them up here all at one time. My secretary made these fall in from the top. I hope that doesn't make anybody think they're falling off their chair. Okay, now you got four things that people worry about as they get older. The first one is dying too soon. That is, dying before your family is taken care of. The second one is living too long or outliving their assets. Now, as I told you, I have a master's in public health, and I worked with Dr. John Scharfenberg in some health education programs a couple of summers. And we did this coronary risk evaluation called Heartbeat. And when we're doing one of the evaluations, this one guy in a conversation in public in the meeting, he stated, "If I had known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself." Well, the same thing is true about this. You know, if you'd known you were going to live this long, you would have provided more for the future. Then the third one is catastrophic illness. You can describe a scenario, like if you have a serious condition, health condition of some kind. I won't try to describe one, but you could lose all of your assets at one time, right? And then number four is mental or physical disability. Who's going to take care of you if you lose your ability to take care of yourself? These are common fears of older people. Now, I'm going to show you something else. Insurance companies make fortunes on these fears. People voluntarily give insurance companies billions of dollars every year to take away these fears. Is that true or not? Now, how does insurance work? Why do insurance companies have tall buildings in almost every city? Insurance kind of works like this. You know, as I'm getting older now, and just a few years from my retirement, I'm starting to feel aches and pains. Something might happen to me really bad. And if it happens, boy, it's going to cost me an arm and a leg. Maybe literally. And so I think I'll get some insurance. Well, the insurance companies are willing to sell you insurance for about anything you can think of. And you can't eventually, you know, you don't have enough money to buy insurance for every possible eventuality, so you really need just basic coverage. But what does the insurance company think? They don't think something big is going to happen to you and it's going to be real bad. They're saying, well, something might happen to you or this guy or this girl down the line somewhere, but it probably won't be near as bad as they think it is. Guess who's usually right? Insurance company. Isn't that interesting? So when commenting on these four fears of older people, Ellen White made this interesting statement. All of these fears originate with Satan. That's volume one of the testimonies, 423, 424. Now, the reason there's two pages there is because she first comments on the four fears of older people. She says people worry about these things as they get older, but all these fears originate with Satan. Now, why do you think Satan wants us to hold on to our assets? You remember the workers' meeting that I told you that Ellen White oversaw? Keep the means in our own ranks. If they get them into the cause, it'll hurt us. You know, that kind of thing. So these fears originate with Satan. We're going to go on and look at another few things here. And I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on these. Everybody knows what they are. So we're going to just go on to these 3 points here. What do you think I would say is the first prerequisite for retirement? To be debt-free, out of debt, okay? That's what the answer is to number one. The first prerequisite, to be debt-free. The second one is health and health care considerations. Now, what we actually mean by that is as you get older, likely there will be some opportunities or need for you to seek health care. But what I'm going to share with you here is something interesting. And that is, if we follow the principles of health that we know, we will live longer. It won't just seem longer. We'll live an abundant life longer. Now, people, I remember as a young health educator, I was asked to speak to a Rotary Club one time. And I talked about the 6 extra years and how Adventists had this percentage less of different kinds of cancers and heart disease and so on. And finally, one guy raised his hand, well, what do Adventists die from? Well, we die from the same things everybody else does, but it's longer, later in life. We live an abundant life longer, generally, and that's the principle that we recognize and follow. So, you understand the acronym for the health principles, the New Start, nutrition, exercise, water, sunlight, and so on, those kind of things. If we only practiced what we preached, we would be a whole lot healthier than we are. I can tell you that some people live and act like we've never been given a health message. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because I'm not the health educator here this year. But you know I'm telling you the truth. Is that right? What we want to do is practice the principles, and those are important. And then the last one, and this is one that I learned a long time ago, taper off, don't quit. People can hardly wait till the day they retire, but guess what? Some of the people that retired in Toronto 2.5 years ago from the General Conference still put their suit on and come to the GC every day because they just can't give it up, as we say. Well, it's a much better thing to, for example, relieve missionaries from their posts on them furloughs or go on short-term mission trips or get involved in doing something. But what we found out here is something interesting. Taper off, don't quit. They did studies, apparently some time ago, of graduates of Harvard University. And they followed them for 10 years. And they found that those who just quit to a life of ease, 10 years later, 75% were dead. But if they continued working in some capacity, 10 years later, 75% were still alive. Isn't that interesting? So the bottom line is, we would rust out quicker than we would wear out. Do you understand? Just sitting around is not good for your health. So you continue to be involved in some way. Now, I'll put up a few points to consider here. More than one source of income. Then you try to minimize the size of your expenses. Now, people ask me what my retirement program is, and it's three steps. It's real, real simple. Mine is to be debt-free, including my home, to have my Social Security, and to have my sustentation thing from the church. I'm not planning to retire as a millionaire and cruises around the world and all of that. If I have spare time and money, I'm going to get involved in short-term mission trips and those kinds of things. Do you understand? Because I'm planning to leave here soon anyway, and I don't want much of my stuff to get burned up when the Lord comes. So it's just pretty simple. Somebody told me even while I was here, well, we can't have confidence in Social Security, can we? No. But when Social Security goes, it will be time for the ravens to feed us. You're understanding it's going to be one of the last things because of its political overtones. You know, that's really simple. Okay. Now we're going to go on and look at this one here, minimize expenses. I do not know any idea what the expenses for taxes are like where you live, but in Washington, D.C. area, the taxes are very expensive. When someone retires from the General Conference, it's written in our policy book there that you cannot have a big party for them, even if they worked there for 40 years. The most you can do is have a little reception in the atrium, and you can have cookies and punch and have somebody play the piano, and they can come by and greet you and tell you goodbye, and that's it. It's just to be, you know, common, low-key type stuff. And so this happens every once in a while that somebody retires. And someone that I knew very well was retiring. And so, of course, I signed the book and went by and talked with them. And I asked this person, where are you planning to retire? Because let me tell you, because of the noise and the pollution, the crime and the violence and all the traffic and some, the day God is finished with me in Washington, D.C., I am out of there. Do you understand? Michigan or North Carolina or Tennessee or someplace where there's, you know, not so much traffic. I'd rather have deer. Okay. The point I'm going to tell you is I said to this man, where are you planning to retire? He says, well, I guess I'm not going to leave this area. I've got my house paid for now, and I'll just stay here. You know, I've lived here for so long. And so he knew I wasn't being nosy when I asked the next question. I said, would you mind sharing with me, what are your taxes for your house? And he has a little postage stamp lot, quarter acre in Tacoma Park. And his taxes are over $8,000 a year for that little house. We're talking Metro DC, you understand? So, do you understand, even with your house paid, somebody that's good at math, how much is that per month? It's like $800 a month or something, isn't it? Or $700, $650, something like that. I mean, it's like you're paying rent just to live there on your place that's paid for. So I said, you're likely aware that you could move to North Carolina or Kentucky or Tennessee, and you could have a nice big house with several acres of land, and your tax will be less than $1,000 a year. So would you like to save $7,000 a year when you're retired? I would. Do you understand what we're talking about here then? Tax considerations, property, real estate, cost of living, size and location of your house. You don't need a huge house when you retire. Things like that. Things to think about. Okay, we're going to go on now because I will warn you ahead of time that this session number 10, starting on page 31, is the most controversial of all the stuff you will learn from me. I believe it's right, or I wouldn't be presenting it, but it is the least likely followed by you here this afternoon. So we're going to look at it and give it a whirl here. And we have about half an hour left, don't we, in our time? Okay, so here we go. Let me just make this interesting statement. Is God the owner of everything? I'm going to ask you this question first. We know that from the Bible, Psalm 24, verse 1, Psalm 50, verse 12, etc. God is the owner of everything. Since God is the owner of everything, when I'm done with it, what should I do with it? And the answer is give it back to Him. And yet there are people who say words like this: all the church ever thinks about is my money. And when I'm about to die, they're hovering around my last hospital bed wanting to know when I'm going to die so they can get my money. You ever heard anybody talk like that? Sure, they talk like that. Ellen White says if people were smart, they'd take care of themselves while they have their wits about them. And we're going to look at some of those statements. We're going to ask another question. People always say, is it true that Ellen White said you shouldn't leave any money to your kids? So we're going to talk about that too real quickly. And then I want to get into Christian investments. We may have to save that one for tomorrow. But this one is pretty interesting. I believe you'll enjoy seeing it. What happens if you die without a will? Many families do. More than 60% of American families do not have a will or an estate plan. Now, some people say, well, the state gets it. There's a term in law called escheating to the state. And if you do not have any living relatives on the face of the earth, and there's occasionally somebody like that, they can't find anybody that claims they're a relative of this person, then it would escheat to the state to build bridges to fill potholes or something. That's about it. But that rarely happens. The state's laws of intestacy and descent and distribution come into play, and they determine what happens to your money. Typically, it will go to your relatives, whether you like them or not, whether they're Christians or not, whether they need it or not. It goes to your relatives. Now, here's the real interesting thing about it. Assume for a moment that you are a faithful tither, and you give regular systematic offerings every paycheck you get. And you just love the voice of prophecy and you send them some money every month and 3 ABN, something every month, and so on. If you die without a will, the state assumes that you are an atheist. And in no way would any of your money ever be returned to a church or charity. Isn't that incredible? You have testamentary capacity. You have testamentary in their charitable intent to give it away. You've got to make the initiative to have a will. There's really no question about it. And I will tell you one other interesting thing about it. Having a will does not hasten the day of your death. It only lets you die prepared. Okay? Kathy and I have had wills since we were in our 20s. And since they're on computer now, they can be updated anytime you want to. And probably it's a good idea to think about it every 5 or 10 years, to look it over and make sure it's just like you want it, and so on. So I'm going to give you a couple of interesting things here. The common practice of people, the most common practice, is to do nothing because it makes them think about they're about to die. But the next common practice is to have a will and give all their money to their kids, their grown kids. Am I telling you guys the truth or not? That's the common practice. So we're going to look now and look at something very interesting. And that is, Ellen White made the counsel that the Christian will should be new and different. A Christian's will should be different than the average person. We're going to see what those say. She says in volume 1 of the testimonies, page 199, I was shown the awful fact that Satan and his angels have more to do with the management of the property of God's professed people than the Lord has. Stewards of the last days are unwise. So Satan's workers' meeting is coming to play here. We're going to look at a couple of other ones. If you die without a will, the state assumes, as I told you, that you're an atheist. Really, Everybody does have a will, either one they make or one the state makes for them. The big question is, which kind do you have? And this, your will then, is the crowning act of your stewardship. We understand that we are just as responsible before God with what we do with what's in our estate as what we did with what we had when we were alive. And that's important to know. Okay, I'm going to show you this interesting statement from Ecclesiastes 2:21. I've read the Bible through last year, and I'm just reading Psalm 119 today, so I'm that far through the Bible. And I've already read before several times in my devotions this interesting chapter from Ecclesiastes. Why would anybody ever want to read Proverbs or Ecclesiastes? Because they were written by the world's smartest man. Is that right? That's what the Bible says. Nobody had wisdom like this guy. He said, through inspiration, "For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom and knowledge and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil." That's Ecclesiastes 2:21. So the Christian's will is new and different. And we're going to look at now some real quick statements so you can understand the focus here. Your wife and children, of course, should not be left destitute. Provision should be made for them if they are needy. But do not simply, because it is customary, bring into your will a long line of relatives who are not needy. Now I want you to understand, how old are most people when they die? Most Adventists. Have you ever seen the obituary section in the Review and our union papers and so on? How old are most Adventists when they die? In their 80s, 90s sometimes. We have two children, and we were having our daily devotions one time when the kids were just in academy. We sent to Andrew and Melissa, "Your mom and I are going to update our wills again, and we're contemplating doing something now that we've read this in the Spirit of Prophecy. Would you rather have your inheritance when we're 85 and you're 60, or would you rather have it when you finish college?" What do you think they said? When we need it, you know, when we start out in life and so on. So I will tell you that when our kids graduated from college, we gave them their inheritance right then. They know now that when we die, if Jesus hasn't come before, you know, if it's time for us to die, that they'll get a little token gift to acknowledge their family connection with us. But most of our money will be going to global mission to help finish the work. And funny thing happened. When we moved from Maryland to Washington, D.C. about 11 years ago, Andrew was in high school and he was helping load the big truck. And the file cabinet that had our wills, our copy of the wills, the door opened and it slid out. Fortunately, it didn't dump everything out. But Andrew's eye caught last will and testament. So he said, he took it out, got a copy of the will, folded it in thirds, and stuck it in his front pocket. Well, no one was looking. And he didn't tell us this until months later we were having worship in Washington, D.C. area. He says, "Dad, I guess I should tell you this. When we were moving, the file drawer came out. It didn't dump out or anything, but I saw this will thing. And so I took the liberty of taking the will out and reading it out loud to Melissa, his sister." He says, "One thing for sure, we're better off with you alive than dead." Because they can still get stuff out of us while we're alive, you understand. But I'm going to talk to you about the real orderly way that we're going to talk about it here. "Let it ever be kept in mind," she says, volume 4, page 483, "that the present selfish system of disposing of property is not God's plan, but man's device. Christians should be reformers and break up this present system, giving an entirely new aspect to the formation of wills." Now we're going to look at something interesting, how that happens. That which many propose to defer until they are about to die, if they were Christians, indeed they would do while they have a strong hold on life. They would devote themselves and their property to God, and while acting as His stewards, they would have the satisfaction of doing their duty. Now here comes the new and different part. By becoming their own executors, they could meet the claims of God themselves instead of shifting the responsibility on others. Now, everybody here knows how an executor works. When does an executor actually work? After someone dies. They appoint someone to be their executor. Now, obviously, if you have a will, you need to have an executor. But she says, why not be your own executor and distribute your assets while you're alive so you can see the good it will do? Does that make sense to anybody? Makes sense to me. And your testamentary documents then are simply to take care of what you didn't distribute while you were alive. Pretty interesting when you see that. So we're going to look at a few more interesting statements. Those who hold fast their property till the last moment surrender it to death rather than to the cause. Losses are occurring continually. Banks fail. Property is consumed in very many ways. Satan works to prevent the means from coming into the treasury at all. Now, to the aged who are losing their hold on this life, I appeal to make a right decision, or disposition, excuse me, of your Lord's goods. So whose money is it? God's. Make a right disposition of your Lord's goods before you fall asleep in Jesus. Remember that you are God's stewards. Do not fail of attending to this while you have your reason. Now, I'm just going to tell you something interesting. I have a fairly good education, and I find that when I read the Spirit of Prophecy, Ellen White knows everything I know. Now, if I were going to say this, I would have said, make sure you make out your documents while you still have testamentary capacity. That means you've got your wits about you to know what your assets are and who your beneficiary should be and what your debts are. You understand? Do you believe that it is possible to be alive and not able to make a will? Sure. A lot of people are alive today, but they kind of don't know what's going on anymore. Too late for them to make a will. Because if they made one, they would need assistance, and then somebody could challenge their will and say that they had undue influence. You understand? That's the point. So while you got your wits about you, do it. As age comes upon us, it is our duty to make a disposition of our means to the instrumentalities that God has established. And then she says the Lord would have his followers dispense their means while they can do it themselves. Some may inquire, must we actually dispossess ourselves of everything which we call our own? The answer is we may not be required to do this now, but we must be willing to do so for Christ's sake. We must acknowledge that our possessions are absolutely his by using them freely whenever means is needed to advance the cause. Now, there's three little short statements that describe the same situation from a different focus. Here they are. There are aged ones among us who are nearing the close of their probation. What are they going to be doing? They're going to die soon. But for the want of wide awake men to secure to the cause of God the means in their possession, it passes into the hands of those who are serving Satan. Then she says, this means was only lent them of God to be returned to him. But in 9 cases out of 10, these brethren, when passing from the stage of action, appropriate God's property in a way that cannot glorify him, for not $1 of it will ever flow into the Lord's treasury. Now here's the second statement. Here is a man with God's money or property in his hands. Remember the other one said he's about to close his probation? This one says he's about to change his stewardship. What's he going to do? He's about to die. Will he place the means which God has lent him to be used in his cause in the hands of wicked men just because they're his relatives? Should not Christian men feel interested and anxious for that man's future good as well as for the interest of God's cause, that he shall make a right disposition of his Lord's money, the talents lent him for wise improvement? Will his brethren stand by and see him losing his hold on this life and at the same time robbing the treasury of God? This would be a fearful loss to himself and to the cause, for by placing his talent of means in the hands of those who have no regard for the truth of God, he would, to all intents and purposes, be wrapping it in a napkin and hiding it in the earth. Now, who did that in the Bible? Remember? This is real interesting. Some people are mentioning Achan, but this one is making reference to the talents in Matthew 25, where the guy that had 5 talents used them and got 5 more, and the guy that had 2 used them and got 2 more. But what did the guy that only had 1 do? He hid it in the earth. He was the unfaithful one. And by the way, this might be something for us to think about. In this parable, is it the rich guy or the poor guy that was unfaithful? Even if we have only a little, we have responsibility. And that's important to know. Okay, we're going to look at this one. Remember God's ownership, the three proper uses of money, and what percent to God. Now, I'm going to tell you something pretty interesting here. I had a speaking invitation in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, to speak to ASI when my kids were academy age. And my parents then were living in Bonners Ferry, Idaho. And so we thought, well, I'll just buy a ticket for Kathy and the kids. The organization that invited me was buying my ticket. So I was going to get all four tickets with my American Express card. And then I would get reimbursed for mine only. But the others would be part of our vacation expense. And I got to thinking, you know, I'm not really afraid of flying. I rather enjoy it sometimes. But if this plane went down somewhere up in Wyoming over Yellowstone Park, what would happen to all the stuff we have? Because by using my American Express card, I got $500,000 of life insurance for each person who got a ticket. You understand how that stuff works, don't you? And then the travel agent was offering $100,000 for each ticket, also of life insurance. That comes automatic through the travel office. So if our plane crashed, in the law, there's these quirks that say, typically, that the man is the one that is presumed to take the last gasp. So everything goes into his pile here. And so what would my estate be worth, actually, at that point? $2.4 million plus all of my considerable assets. That part is a joke. But what I want you to understand is at least $2.4 million. Do you understand? Now, the way I had written my will at that time was, and it had been written maybe 10 years before this, and I thought it might be a good time to review the will, that if our family died in a common accident, that the executor of my estate would give the church 20%, not just a tithe, a double tithe. I thought God should be thrilled with that. But now I knew better. And so Kathy and I, both changed our wills. Instead of lining up my grown brothers and Kathy's grown siblings and so on, we decided that since they were already grown and didn't need our money, that we would give 80% to God and 20% to our aged parents who may need assistance in the last years of their life. So we just changed it completely around. Now, after I show you these next few things, I'm going to show you something interesting. And that's the responsibility of the children. Obviously, anybody, it's a no-brainer to understand if you have dependent children, children that haven't reached the age of majority and still live in your house and so on, if you have those kind of children, that should be your first responsibility. Does everybody understand that? That's basic stuff. But what we're talking about here is grown children. Like me, what happens when my mother dies? Do you understand? I'm a kid to her. I'm the only person in the world she's the only person in the world that calls me Eddie. I'm still 8 years old to her. Do you understand? I'm Eddie. I won't tell you some other names that she calls me. But the point is, I'm still her little boy. I'm a kid. I'm her kid. Well, when should we maximize gifts to children, and when should we minimize gifts to children? So we're going to read two or three statements. I'm going to give you a conclusion. Then we'll wind this up. Parents should exercise the right that God has given them. He has entrusted to them the talents that he would have them use to his glory. The children were not to become responsible for the talents of the father. While they have sound minds and good judgment, parents should, with prayerful consideration and with the help of proper counselors who have experience in the truth and a knowledge of the divine will, make disposition of their property. Now listen carefully. If they have children who are afflicted, what do we mean by that? This means that maybe they have a birth defect or something that has maybe made them so they weren't able to make their own living and they need care through their life. If they're afflicted or they're struggling in poverty and who will make a judicious use of means, they should be considered. But if they have unbelieving children who have an abundance of this world, they commit a sin against the master who has made them his stewards by placing means in their hands merely because they are their children. Then we're going to look at another one. Parents should have great fear of entrusting children with the talents and means which God has placed in their hands unless they have the surest evidence that their children have greater interest in, love for, and devotion to the cause of God than they themselves possess, and that these children will be more earnest and zealous in forwarding the work of God and more benevolent in carrying forward the various enterprises connected with it which calls for means. But many place their means or money in the hands of their children, thus throwing upon them the responsibility of their own stewardship. Why? Because Satan prompts them to do it. In so doing, they effectually place that means in the enemy's ranks. Very interesting. Now I'm going to tell you a story. I gave this seminar to a group of business people one time. And a lady came to me, and she stated many years ago, I think it was like 60 years ago, she and her husband moved to the country closer to a large city, and they bought about 100 acres of land, I think, and he raised soybeans on it. They built themselves a house on it and so on. But she said, my husband has passed away. Typically, 80% of the time, the husband predeceases his wife, who leaves the wife to take care of all the estate. At any rate, she said, as I was getting older, I really wasn't sure what to do with my estate. But she said, I guess I should tell you that things have changed in our neighborhood since we bought the property these many years ago. She said, for example, there's now a 4-lane highway right through our property that we sold the easement to. And so we have some property on each side. Recently, she said, a man came and knocked on my door and said, I'm interested in buying your property. And she said, sorry, but it's not for sale. And he said, well, couldn't I just leave you one of my business cards? And the man, she invited him in, and he said, well, he says, I know you're not interested right now, but should you ever decide to sell, give us a call. And he said, by the way, I will give you our offer on the property. And the property... This is really, really incredible now, what she said. I wrote this in the book, and I'm not exactly thinking of the right number, but I will just tell you what I know the total was. He gave her a card and left. She looked at the card, and it was Walmart Corporation. And they said, our offer today is $12 million. For this property that she had left. Of course, they were going to divide it up and sell off to other people and so on. She said, we paid $30 an acre for it. Then she said, I had already made my will. And she said, I have two children. One of them is an orthodontist who's in his mid-50s and doing quite well. And the other one is a stockbroker, and he also is doing quite well. And I had made my will out to give half of my estate to one and half to the other. Isn't that incredible? So you understand. Now I'm going to talk to you about, we'll go through a few of these and see something interesting. If parents, while they live, would assist their children to help themselves, it would be better than to leave them a large amount at death. In other words, help them start out in life rather than waiting until you're about to die. Children who are left to rely principally on their own exertions make better men and women, are better fitted for practical life than those children who have depended upon their father's estate. This is Testimonies, Volume 3, 122. So, here's the conclusion that I came to. Children should always be remembered in your will if they are dependent and needy, if they are afflicted, or if they'll be more liberal with God's cause than the parents were. But they should not be remembered if they are unbelieving, if they have an abundance, or they are serving the world. Now, I'm going to tell you another story. This is some time ago now. I guess it was probably 10 years ago. My mother called me one evening, and she says, Eddie, your father and I have finally decided to make our wills. And he was 73, has since passed away. Next month, my mother will be 80 and still living and quite healthy, praise the Lord. But at any rate, she said, we've decided to make our wills, but we have this problem. She said, you know there are four boys, and you and one of your brothers are real active in the church, and we know you love Jesus, and we know you do things right with it, and so on. But two of my brothers, the oldest one and the youngest one, are out of the church, and they're not living as they should, and they know it. Everybody understand that? But she said to me, if we give you and your other brother the money, then the two worldly guys will say, if that's the way that Christian parents treat their kids, we don't want anything to do with the church, and it'll make it worse. You've heard that, haven't you? So I said, Mother, I've been studying this, and here's what I think you should do. I know that you took a job as a nurse aide to help us get through church school. And she went back to Madison College and became a nurse when I was in academy so that she could be available to help us through college. I said, you've done all God has asked you to do. You've provided for us. We're all grown men now. I think you should treat all of us exactly alike. And what I think you should do is, if you guys die before Jesus comes, leave us each $500 to buy an airplane ticket to your funeral and give the rest of it all back to God. My mother started crying on the phone, and she says, Eddie, that's what I was hoping you would say. She'd been reading the stuff herself. She knew what was right. And then she said, you know, our church is building a new church, and your daddy and I wanted to do something good for that. And the voice of prophecy brought us into the church. We wanted to make a contribution to them, and so on. So I have the unusual distinction as an attorney of having drafted my own parents' wills. And so I know that if my mother dies before Jesus comes, that all four of us boys will get $500 and the rest of it will go to finish the work. That's what a Christian will is like. That's very, very important to understand. Okay, we're going to go on and look at another real interesting topic here because we have a couple of minutes. Let me see here. Let me just say we only have 2 minutes left. Maybe we should save investment and the other things for tomorrow. Many parents make a great mistake in placing their property out of their hands into the hands of their children while they themselves are responsible for the use or abuse of the talent that God has lent them. Neither parents nor children are made happier by this transfer of property. So the best legacy that parents can leave their children is love for God, a willingness to work, and a good education. Does that make sense? You understand those basic points. I think that's where we are here. Father, I thank you for the privilege we have of being together with you. I pray that you'll bless us as we contemplate the things that we've learned. May our hearts be open to not only understanding, but following and practicing the principles of your word in the spirit of prophecy. Dismiss us now with your blessing in Jesus' name.
This media was produced by Hope Media Ministry. If you have been blessed by this media, you may want to consider a donation to help support our efforts to spread these important and timely messages. For this and other great witnessing material, please visit our media center at www.hopevideo.com. Our address is Hope Media Ministry, P.O. Box 752, Ada, that's A-D-A, Michigan, 49301. You can also email us at hope@hopevideo.com. Our media includes DVD, video, CD audio, and cassette. You can also listen to much of our media for free at our online media center at www.hopevideo.com. That's hopevideo.com.